In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Since you're listening to this podcast, we have a very special offer for you. You can try 6 issues of BBC History Revealed magazine for just £9.99. That's a saving of 70% on the shop price. BBC History Revealed is the all-action history magazine suitable for the whole family. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. And if you're based in the US, you won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just £9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. Both these offers end on the 15th of May, 2021. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. After the invasion of the Viking Great Army by the latter part of the 9th century, historians speak about there being a separate part of what's now Eastern and Northern England called the Danelaw, where Scandinavian laws and customs prevailed. But what actually was the Danelaw and how should we understand it? Our content director, Dave Musgrove, called Dr. Ben Raffield of the University of Uppsala to find out.
Okay, so today I'm joined by Dr. Ben Raffield, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Archaeology and Ancient History at Uppsala University in Sweden. He wrote a very interesting article, The Danelaw Reconsidered, Colonisation and Conflict in Viking Age England, in the 2020 issue of the journal Viking and Medieval Scandinavia. So I thought maybe we could consider and reconsider the Danelaw on the podcast today. So Ben, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this.
Good to have you on. So first thing we really need to delve into is to establish what the Danelaw is. What do we mean by this term, the Danelaw?
So in the general understanding of this term, I mean, we're talking about an area of Eastern and Northern England that was conquered, as it were, and settled by Scandinavian groups during the late 9th century. This is a process that began in the 860s with the arrival of the so-called Viking Great Army, who arrived in Eastern England and proceeded to conquer and annex the territories of York, East Anglia, and the Midlands, what was then Mercia. And this became a focus of quite substantial settlement from the 860s to 870s onwards for several generations. And that really is the geographical focus of this area that we call the Danelaw. More than that, it's also a term that has since been used to define this area culturally. And actually, the usage of this term goes back all the way to the medieval period. So from the outset, actually, what we're dealing with here is several different constructs of what the Danelaw is. It's a term that first appears in the 10th century, for example, when the English king at the time, Edgar. He decreed that the Danes living in England could actually exercise their rights to live as best as their own legal frameworks allowed, in contrast to people living under English law. And this later in the 11th century actually appears as a term, Danelaga, meaning the areas under Danish law. But in the 12th century, this becomes almost a geopolitical term. The Dane law is this part of northern and eastern England, which exists in contrast to Wessex and Mercia in the south and west. And this is enshrined in various law codes of the time. So really, it's what is originally a descriptive term used to describe, cultural and especially legal differentiation in England. It very quickly, over the course of a couple of centuries, morphs into something very different. And today, when we talk about the Dane law, really what we are referring to, even implicitly, is this kind of later definition. This is a geographical place or space within which things are happening during the early medieval period and the Middle Ages. So it's quite hard to say in that sense what the Dane law actually is. But it's maybe a concept. It's an idea that reflects very many different different ideas held by people at different times.
So, but what we need to understand for our listeners is how these Danish people, these mm-hmm. Scandinavians, were in this bit of land that is conceptualized mm-hmm. as the Danelaw. So that takes us back to the Viking Great Army, mm-hmm. I guess, in the mid 9th century, in 860s. So you better just drop us into this story here. And I think maybe also while we're talking, we ought to be clear about what you're comfortable with in terms of nomenclature, Vikings and Anglo-Saxons as well. These would be the two mm-hmm. sort of groups that that could be involved in this, and those terms are somewhat contentious.
Sure. And when we talk about the Danelaw, I mean, we have to, in one sense, which I didn't do, is begin with this group, the Great Army, which arrives in England in the 860s, and spends the next decade or so traveling around England, campaigning in England, taking on and effectively conquering a number of the regional kingdoms that were in existence at the time. And as I said, so the Danelaw in this sense is, at a fundamental level, this area that becomes annexed or conquered and settled by the Great Army. And of course, after that, subsequent waves of settlers coming over from Scandinavia and elsewhere, leading into the 10th century, and generally it's defined in terms of our modern regional understanding in England as the counties, especially of Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, down into the Midlands, Northamptonshire, Cambridgeshire, Bedfordshire, and across into East Anglia, Norfolk, Suffolk, and at least originally, probably what is Essex and part of Greater London. So it's a really quite considerable area, previously occupied, or ruled over by various regional English kings that becomes, settled, essentially. And that's the word I like to use more than anything, as opposed to kind of conquered and ruled. It's settled by the Great Army, elements of the Great Army, and later Scandinavian settlers. And it's, of course, you can make things extra complicated by talking about terminology. And the essence of this article that I've written is to kind of try and understand better the idea of the Danelaw. So that's something we will return to. But we can talk about the people occupying this part of the landscape. We could, many people would refer to them as Vikings or Viking settlers. This is a term we are all familiar with. We have a very good idea of what that means. But I I think rather clumsily, but for the right reasons, I like to feel. I refer to this area, you know, that we call the Danelaws, as kind of Scandinavian occupied England, generally. Because what we have here, the groups that are part of this Viking Great Army, they are generally a number of autonomous groups of varying size. We have no idea how large these individual groups were in the Great Army, that have joined together and come over to England, presumably with the purpose and intent of settling land and taking land. So in that sense, you know, I mean, they're not fulfilling that kind of stereotypical image of the Vikings that we have in our minds. You know, they're not just coming here with, you know, the intent of pursuing violence. You know, that's what we associate with the Viking Age. They are, of course, a militarized force, and, you know, they are, everything they do is to a great extent governed by you know, this idea of forcefully taking land. But at the same time, there is a clear intent to settle and to establish themselves with a sense of permanence in the English landscape. So in that sense, I don't refer to these people as Vikings. For me, that's a term we use to, you know, explicitly discuss the maritime raiders, you know, the pirates of the early medieval world, you know, mostly from Scandinavia, but they're not all exclusively comprising Scandinavians. So as I said, you know, terminology can take us into a lot of complicated areas, but I think it's kind of important to establish that. So just as we're talking about the idea of the Vikings, we need to also talk about the ideas of Anglo-Saxon England, or these people that are commonly referred to as the Anglo-Saxons. And this is another term, you know, that is equally complicated in its own ways, and that it's very homogenizing, and it applies a very broad brush to many, many groups of people living in what is England now, during the early medieval period. And if we really want to understand what's going on in England at this time, I think we need to think more regionally and even locally. So actually, and there's lots of different terms now that we can use, and people are actually debating this currently, is, you know, how do we deal with this idea of Anglo-Saxon England? But for me personally, in the last few years, I've kind of started gravitating towards this idea of the early English kingdoms, the kingdoms that would, you know, eventually become what we now know today as England. So as I said, you know, terminology can take us into a lot of kind of complicated discussions, and they're not always ones that we need to really, you know, pursue in a lot of depth, depending on what we're talking about. But it's good to be aware of that, for sure.
The context here is that you had these Viking raids, mm-hmm. from the end of the 8th century through for the next few decades until we get to the Great Army, and so there'd been a lot of activity around the coast of Britain and Ireland during that period, mm-hmm. and then we get this Great Army coming and a larger group of people coming with, as you say, possibly different intentions to the first tranche of people who arrived, and so we get this settlement period. How many people were coming from Scandinavia to this part of England, and over what length of time?
This is one of those how long is a piece of string questions, I think. So the scale of these, what was described in the past, these kind of invasions and settlement, has been debated. I mean, in terms of the Great Army itself, for example, in the latter part of the 20th century, it was actually suggested that this Great Army might have numbered a few hundred people. This is an idea that's changed radically since the turn of the millennium. And, you know, I think myself and my colleagues would mostly agree that, you know, we're talking about a group numbering at least in the low thousands at this point. So it's quite a sizable force. And then following this, as I said, kind of, you know, subsequent waves of settlers, and also actually something I didn't mention, which is important, you know, subsequent, you know, raiding fleets, they're still showing up, moving into the 10th century. And, you know, some of them are clearly engaging in dialogue with these settled populations and probably settling among them themselves. But my my colleague, Jane Kershaw, at the University of Oxford, working with another one of my colleagues, Ellen Royovic, they've recently, in a study of the early settlement population of England, I mean, they've now come to a realistic estimate. We're talking about several tens of thousands of people. They suggest 20 to 35,000 arriving in what they call the core Danelaw counties. So between about, Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, Suffolk, Norfolk, over the, a course of several generations. So when we add to that, maybe non-core Danelaw counties. So, we're talking about Leicestershire, Northamptonshire, Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire. These are also being settled. So I think we could probably take that estimate and probably add a little more onto it. But as I said, we ultimately, it's very hard to tell. My view is this is probably a much... much larger settlement than people would have previously estimated. And of course, I think that leads to further questions. You have quite large numbers of people arriving in a landscape that's incredibly well ordered, hierarchically, politically, socially. This isn't like, where we have Scandinavians settlers going off into the North Atlantic and settling in Iceland, for example. Where they can establish their own landholdings. Those people arriving in England have to fit into an ordered landscape, and in my view, that has to have some kind of implication. Whether those are violent implications or even just social and cultural and political implications that have to be negotiated. These people can't just turn up and take whatever land they want. This needs to be ordered somehow.
So let's just drill into that a second. So the time period here for this movement is the last third of the ninth century and the first half of the 10th century.
Sure, we can talk broadly from the 870s into the early 900s. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a reasonably substantial population movement coming in. Mm-hmm. Is that swamping the existing population? Can I pin you down on the number of people who are the incumbents?
I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that, honestly. But as I said, I think just based on the numbers of people arriving, I mean, this is a landscape that is parceled up. It is owned. And controlled very strictly. So even in sense of, whether it's certain areas are densely populated, that they're still owned by someone. And so we, as I said, what implications that means, kind of this process that we might call land taking or settlement or colonization. For me, the number of the size of that population isn't necessarily the biggest factor to consider. It's the general social impact of that settlement.
So what do we know about the interaction then between those people, the people who came and the people who were there? Was it violent or was it peaceful, or is that, or do we, can we not, can we not generalize?
Yeah, I don't think we can. I think it's a of course, when we have the Great Army arriving in England in the 860s, this is an incredibly violent period. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, in such detail as it offers, is quite explicit in describing the battles taking place, and as I said, the conquest of these regional English kingdoms. But following this, if we're starting to talk about this process of settlement. It's difficult, I mean, I think naturally one would assume that there's an element of coercive power. This is, as I said, it's an armed group settling the landscape. But, moving into the 10th century itself, when we start to see the conquest of this region by Alfred of Wessex and his descendants. I have thought a lot about, you know, how that would have been perceived by, as you said, the incumbent population of England, you know, the English themselves, as it were, because these are regional kingdoms, you know, and especially we're talking about settlement taking place over generations. You know, these are communities that would have, you know, even if they started off with a sense of kind of, you know, opposition to each other in the early settlement phase, over generations, these people would come together. And we see this in the material record, you know, through the creation of what we might call hybridized material culture, the creation of jewelry, for example, incorporating both Scandinavian and what is described archaeologically as Anglo-Saxon influences. So there is, of course, a mixing of peoples and a kind of a coalescence, a coming together of different groups. But honestly, the part of what I find, again, fascinating about this is we have no idea really about how these processes are playing out. You know, the limited information we get from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it doesn't tell us much about what's happening in Eastern and Northern England at this time. And, you know, we're in a deeply historical period here where we have this abundance of texts. But in my own work, I've often thought of, you know, the Danelaw, as it were, as a kind of, it's a prehistoric landscape, because there's very few sources that we can actually rely on to get an idea about what's happening within this area.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It's why, you know, we will always use the term Vikings, and we will talk about the Vikings. You know, this isn't, you know, this isn't an ethnonym, but we use it to conceptualize groups of people at a certain time doing certain things. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to go around being the Danelaw police, you know. I mean, that's not what I want to do.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
But I suppose underpinning all of this is the question of how culturally similar or otherwise the people who were living in what became the Danelaw and the people who came into it from Scandinavia were. And, you know, the big differentiator that's always flagged up is religion, Christianity versus paganism. Take that away, and are these people one of the same, really?
It's an interesting question. I mean, and of course, you know, we also have to talk about, as it were, the different groups coming into England as well, these Scandinavian groups or groups from elsewhere as well. But we can start with the, you know, as you say, talking about, you mentioned the kind of the Christian and non-Christian dichotomy there. One thing that scholars have, for great part, drawn attention to is this, what seems to be a relatively quick process of acculturation. You know, the idea that incoming settlers would very quickly take on English, you know, traditions, belief systems. Of course, they assimilate into the structures of society. But if you take that away, of course, there's still going to be differences between people. I mean, you know, at least among, you know, actual, you know, the people undertaking the settlements. I mean, there's going to be language differences, even though English and Norse dialects may have had a degree of, a mutual similarity. But I mean, you know, these are people who still speak a different language to you, or at least, you know, they speak a heavily different dialect.
I was under the impression that Old Norse and Old English were kind of mutually intelligible at this
point. Sure, but I mean, but noticeably not, I would think.
Sure.
You know, okay. So I mean, and dialects as today, you know, in England, I mean, you know, you can identify very easily people who are not from the same place as you by dialect, you know. On top of that, of course, I mean, you know, these settlers are bringing with them their own material culture, which, as I said, you know, over time, goes through this really interesting process of hybridization with local influences and also continental influences coming in. But at the same time, there is still these kind of what seems to be, and again, my colleague Jane Kershaw has done a lot of work on this. You know, there are still, you know, kind of overtly Scandinavian expressions of material culture in the archaeological record. You know, in terms of what we see in jewelry, for example. And Jane has suggested, you know, like in certain situations, you may have been politically or socially advantageous to show that you were culturally affiliating with a Scandinavian identity. So, you know, these things remain salient. But as I said, I think we also need to think about the nature of the settlers themselves, and not just, you know, place them in opposition, as it were, to the local populations. I mean, the groups that, you know, for example, were traveling within the Great Army, I mean, you know, they would have, of course, recognized that they shared a common cultural background. They would have shared the same language, even if there was dialectal differences. But at the same time, you know, these people aren't coming from one country and going to England. You know, this isn't, you know, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, these don't exist at this point in time. So actually the groups settling the landscapes themselves were disparate groups. Probably, you know, in Scandinavia, I mean, you know, identities and affiliations are much more local. Perhaps, you know, they're kind of regionally bounded. But again, while you might recognize, you know, the people that you're traveling with in the Great Army, or you're settling alongside in the landscape with, you know, as you know, coming from Scandinavia and ascribing, you know, to a Scandinavian culture, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a, you know, a clear sense of belonging there, a mutual shared identity.
So might that be the case then, that a group of incumbent English occupants in a part of the Danelaw might welcome some Scandinavian settlers coming in with, you know, with big swords and axes who look like they can defend you from other potential threats?
I think, obviously, as I said, in the very early period, I think maybe not so much. But moving into the 10th century, when we see these concerted efforts by Wessex, essentially, you know, says Alfred and his descendants to annex these territories. And of course, you know, in the political propaganda at the time, as it were, you know, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, I mean, these conquests of the Danelaw, if we use that term, you know, this is presented as something as a liberation. This is Alfred's successors liberating the people of eastern northern England from the Danes. I think the people they refer to as the Danes. When we first, you know, in 942, for example, this is when we first come across the term the Five Boroughs. We see that King Edmund is being described as liberating these five settlements in the Midlands. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says, you know, these are people who are held, you know, essentially captive by the heathens. You know, so this is some great political, you know, propaganda, as I said. But for the people on the other side of that of that action, the English populations of you know, Northumbria and you know, Lincolnshire and East Anglia themselves, you know, historically, the regional kingdoms of England had, you know, they'd existed alongside but also in opposition to each other. I mean, if you go back in the centuries before the Viking Age, there's constant cycles of warfare between these different kingdoms. So when we then move, you know, we have the great army and it's, you know, the subsequent settlers occupying this landscape. When it comes to the kind of the process of unification, as it were, that begins with Alfred and his successors, I think certainly there may have been some resistance to that. And in that sense, you know, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't have people we might refer to. It's, of course, and it's very broadly, it's very homogenizing itself, but to describe these people as, you know, English. But you know, these people might have been actively taking up arms against Wessex and Mercia as they're attempting to annex these territories. And again, I think this speaks to these kind of this really complex regional and local dialogue that must have been going on, but which we have, you know, no historical evidence to help us understand.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're kind of arguing here then that we've been sold a Wessex-based interpretation of the development of English history, which, you know, in a way we do because it builds up to Athelstan and the development of the English polity as a consequence of that, and the Anglo-Saxon chronicles that you've referenced started by Alfred the Great, the Wessex ruler in the late 9th century. So are you kind of saying then that the Wessex incursions into East Anglia was more of an affront to the local occupations than the Scandinavian based ones might have been?
The early settlement was it was a process of forced settlement, colonization, conquest, whatever you want to call it. But I think we need to consider the real implications of what those conquests later actually the conquests of this, you know, these areas by Alfred's descendants, what that meant. I myself can't see any reason why, you know, this should have been in the minds of people presented as a liberation. I mean, especially as we have said for so many years, that, you know, the settling populations coming into England, they were mainly, you know, going through processes of acculturation. They're not necessarily enforcing new structures on the population. Maybe they are in some places, of course. But certainly I don't think they're kind of living under, you know, the heathen yoke as they are portrayed in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. So, yeah, and this is my own thoughts, and they're very hard to kind of substantiate in that sense. But, you know, when we have regions like East Anglia and the Midlands being annexed by Edward the Elder, for example, in the early 10th century, we see, you know, patterns of fortification construction, active fortification construction in these territories. And of course, we could suggest that these are, you know, these fortifications are being constructed to provide an infrastructure for the landscape to also counter potential aggression, for example, from Northern England, which was still under Scandinavian control, as it were. But perhaps this is also to kind of, you know, put a stamp on the local population and to bring them under the order of essentially a people who had traditionally might not have been perceived as allies and at times were enemies. Again, I think there's so much to this that we still need to think about and try and order in our minds.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's complicated.
yes.
So let's get simplistic for a second. And I know you're not going to answer this or have an answer to it, but was there ever a formal boundary between something that might be construed as the Danelaw and something that might be construed as English territory?
Actually, in a sense, you know, I think this is something we can talk about. Certainly nothing physical and upstanding. There's no kind of, you know, build a wall.
No hatred.
Yeah. you know, in the period following the Great Army's settlement in the 870s, or during this time, there is a treaty agreed between Alfred of Wessex, or Alfred the Great. And at that point, the one of the main leading, you know, commanders of the Great Army, Guthrum, who actually becomes a ruler in his own right in East Anglia. And at some point between, you know, the 870s and Guthrum's death in 890, if I believe, there is actually a treaty instituted. It's referred to, could be referred to generally as actually the Alfred Guthrum Treaty. And in this, alongside other kind of other legislation, there is actually a very clear attempt to define the boundaries of Alfred's and Guthrum's kingdom. And this is very well known. It can be looked up, but it basically runs along the River Thames into London, up the River Lee to its source, and from there in a straight line. It just says in a straight line to Bedford, and then down the River Ouse to Watling Street, and that's the information we're given. And, you know, so this what this seems to suggest is that there is an attempt to actually establish a formal boundary between Guthrum's and Alfred's kingdom. And in fact, if you were to keep following Watling Street northwest, it's interesting that, for example, when we look at the place name evidence, there doesn't seem to be a lot of Scandinavian place names on the southwestern side of Watling Street. They're very much confined to the north and west, north and east, sorry. So there is some kind of boundary, I think, but this shouldn't be seen, I don't think, in the sense of a border. It's possibly more viewed as a kind of a frontier zone, and people are free to move across that, with violent or non-violent intentions. But what is interesting is actually this boundary very quickly seems to fragment or dissolve, and we see this, just decades after this treaty is agreed. We see, for example, Scandinavian elites selling land in what is Bedfordshire to the west of this boundary, so within what was supposed to be Alfred's kingdom. We see them actually selling land back to the English kings, which implies, at some point there's been a movement of this boundary. So it's certainly permeable, fluid, movable, perhaps. And again, I think that actually speaks to many of the processes taking place in England at this time. This is a fluid and dynamic landscape in every sense of the term.
So if I was able to travel back to the 890s and started a journey from Winchester and travelled up to York. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get my geography wrong now, but if I get to Watling Street and try to cross it, I'm not going to be stopped by a bunch of burly dudes with axes saying can't cross here. Mm-hmm. But am I going to experience, is my experience of the culture, of the language, of society going to be markedly different from one side to the other? What does the archaeological evidence tell us about whether there was any marked actual difference in life between those two areas?
Yeah, from an archaeological perspective, that's actually is quite difficult to say. As I think I've mentioned, that you would notice, for example, I think you would notice a difference in what people are wearing, in their personal ornamentation, the jewelry they wear. You would, it isn't archaeological evidence, but I think there would be notable differences in dialect used. As I said, I think it's quite telling with the place name evidence that we see. This is the Scandinavian influenced place names. They're in the northeast, that side of Watling Street, which doesn't just necessarily suggest that, this is where people were settling, but it's also, there's a different language being spoken here. I think that's probably the thing you would notice most, more than anything else, more than anything visual, in that sense.
Would I feel as if I was sort of in danger as an English person moving into this area? Do you think would I feel like that I was in a threatened landscape?
It's a really good question. As I said, this isn't a border. There's no, as far as I can tell, active attempts to stop people moving across this. And of course, you know, I mean, I presume people, at least regionally and locally, would have traded with each other, for example. So you're going to have movement across this boundary. And even, you know, even when, during periods where there are kind of, you know, there's outright conflict between Viking groups and you know, the English kingdoms, you still, for example, so in addition to, you know, and with this trade, I think it's also telling that, you know, even in periods of actual conflict, outright warfare between various Viking groups and in the English kingdoms, you know, for example, we have in around the 890s, we have the Norwegian merchant Othair, who actually comes to the court of King Alfred, you know, and holds an audience with him. There doesn't seem to be any kind of notion that people of Scandinavian origin are hostile. They're not the enemy, as it were. So I don't think in that sense, no, there wouldn't necessarily been a kind of a tension in that landscape. I mean, this would, of course, at times flare up into real tension and violence, especially as we see the geopolitical map shifting in the late 9th century and early 10th century. But for, you know, the average Joe, as it were, living locally and moving through the landscape, I'm not sure, in fact, that there would have been much sense of hostility and danger there. But of course, that all might depend on how movement through this landscape was monitored and, for example, taxed if you were traveling with the intent of engaging in commerce, which is very, you know, very difficult to get into.
And so when, sort of moving on a bit, when does the Danelaw area and the rest of England sort of come back into being, well, not come back to, but start to be one whole entity where you might not recognise any differences at all?
So I think it's telling, even a couple of centuries following these settlements, when Svein Fortbeard invades England in the early 11th century, that, you know, he arrives in Sandwich, but he straight away heads north and into the Humber. And comes south from there. And this isn't by chance. You know, he probably has a very good idea that people in the north and east are more, you know, they're likely to be sympathetic to him. And indeed, he does gain the support of people in the northern and eastern regions. So even at this stage, you know, this is, you know, over, you know, 100 years after, you know, these areas are being incorporated into the English kingdom, there's still perhaps a notable feeling of difference. And of course, you know, this is when we're talking about the origins of this term, the Danelaw. People in this part of England are governing themselves according to different forms of laws. They are maintaining an active sense of an identity that doesn't conform with that in the West and the South. And so, you know, I mean, the arrival of Svein Fortbeard, for example, you know, might have been a good opportunity for these people to rid themselves of Southern rule. And so in that, I think, you know, this idea of, said, a kind of a difference in cultural identities, I think that actually perseveres for quite some time. I couldn't say maybe when it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Well, I get, you know, I guess it's kind of still recognizable when you get up to 1066 and the Norman conquest, because you've kind of got that sense that, I mean, certainly the Bayeux Tapestry takes a very southern view of the history of that event and overlooks what's going on in the north, and you kind of, Hardrada comes into the north and lands, and you know, there's a sense that perhaps there's still a difference between the southern bit of England and the northern bit of England even then, I think.
Oh no, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, of course, then we have, you know, the invasion from the south of the Normans, and that totally tears up the geopolitical map again. But yeah, I you know, right up until the period of the conquest, I, you know, and likely, you know, it perseveres beyond that as well. So this is the impacts of the settlement. I mean, they're incredibly long lasting. Even if, you know, they're officially, according to the historical record, they're it's a very short period, you know, a few generations in which this area is actively under what we might call Scandinavian control, the descendants of Scandinavians. But the impacts of this are felt for hundreds of years.
Yeah, because as you say, it's a fairly confined period, isn't it, from when the great army are there through to, when is it, like 940s, 950s, when sort of an element of Wessex control over it?
Yeah, when I wrote my PhD, it was 878 to 954, I believe. That's the kind of date I picked there. This is when you had the death of Eric Bloodaxe. The downfall, as it were, of what we call the Kingdom of York. So, I mean, it's a very small, as I said, you're talking about a couple of generations, really.
But with fairly long-lasting consequences. Mm-hmm. So sort of getting towards the end. So we talked about the usefulness or otherwise of this term, the Danelaw, mm-hmm. and what it means to us. And what it means to us today, I suppose, is quite interesting. It's used quite... maybe you would say, I'm not sure, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but is it used injudiciously by people who are using it as a shorthand for something that never really actually existed at the time?
No, and in writing this paper, and of course everyone is free to read it and see what conclusion I came to in this sense. I mean, what I wanted to do was kind of highlight the ambiguities associated with this. With this term, and of course we could write it off as anachronistic, but would that actually achieve anything? If nothing else for the point of being able to write concisely, these terms are incredibly useful. And when you say the word Danelaw, you generally have an idea of this place. And the events taking place within it, even, of course, if that is heavily glossed over and homogenized. But nevertheless, I mean, this term clearly did mean something to people in the medieval period, for example. So even if it's a kind of a term that we use just to highlight legal and cultural differentiation in different parts of England, in that sense, I think it absolutely retains some use. And maybe we just have to be a bit boring, essentially, in explaining exactly what we mean when we use this term. But I think it's, as I said, really what I wanted to show is that there's a lot more maybe to what's taking place in Northern and Eastern England than this term would originally let us, conceive and understand. And rather than thinking perhaps about a Danelaw, what we need to think more about is these kind of many complex processes which I've tried to explain in some way. But these very many fluid and dynamic changes taking place at regional and local levels within communities, I think that's where we start to understand what's happening during this period. For me, if we recognise that, then absolutely, the Danelaw still retains its kind of its use. I think it's just a case of acknowledging and pushing through that term is what we need to do.
Yeah, because we do need these big terms to help us. I mean, we talked about the danger of generalising, but we do need these bigger terms to help us understand what's going on and to bring us into the subject, don't we?
Oh, of course, right. I mean, it's why, we will always use the term Vikings, and we will talk about the Vikings. This isn't an ethnonym, but we use it to conceptualise groups of people at a certain time doing certain things. Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't want to go around being the Danelaw police, I mean, that's not what I want to do.
That was Dr. Ben Raffield. He's based at the University of Uppsala, where he's part of the Viking Phenomenon Project team. If you'd like to read the academic article that was the basis for this podcast, it's an open access publication, so you can read it online. We've put the link in the show notes for you. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow for an episode on everything you wanted to know about Prohibition.